His tender discernment was not at fault. A dark foreboding did indeed shadow the joy that would normally have flooded my being at such a time. We stood on the deck of the vessel that had borne us swiftly across the broad Mediterranean. The breeze of its passage across the blue waters ruffled our hair and tugged at our garments. Ahead, we could see the Egyptian coast, where we would land before the day was over. We were about to enter upon another season of archaeological investigation, the most recent of many we had shared. Soon, we would be exploring the stifling, bat-infested corridors of one pyramid and the muddy, flooded burial chamber of another, scenes that would, under ordinary circumstances, have inspired in me a shiver of rapturous anticipation. How many other women, particularly in that final decade of the 19th century, had so many reasons to rejoice? Emerson, who prefers to be addressed by his surname since he considers Radcliffe affected and effeminate, his very words, had chosen me as his equal partner, not only in marriage, but in the profession we both have the honor to adorn. Emerson is the finest excavator of Egyptian antiquities the world has seen. I do not doubt his name will be revered as the father of scientific excavation, as long as civilization endures upon this troubled globe. And my name, the name of Amelia Peabody Emerson, will be enshrined alongside his. Forgive my enthusiasm, dear reader. The contemplation of Emerson's excellent qualities never fails to arouse emotion, nor is his excellence restricted to his intellectual qualities. I feel no shame in confessing that his physical attributes were not the least of the elements that made me decide to accept his proposal of marriage. From the raven hair upon his broad brow to the dimple, which he prefers to call a cleft, in his chin, he is a model of masculine strength and good looks. Emerson appears to be equally appreciative of my physical attributes. Candidly, I have never fully understood this attitude. Mine is not a type of beauty I admire. Features rather less pronounced, eyes of a softer and paler hue, a figure greater in stature and more restrained in the region above the waist, locks of sunny gold instead of jetty black. These are my ideals of female loveliness. Luckily for me, Emerson does not share them. His large brown hand lay next to mine on the rail of the vessel. It was not the hand of a gentleman, but to me the calluses and scars that marked those tanned and stalwart members were badges of honor. I remembered the occasions on which they had wielded weapons or tools in the course of his labors, and other occasions on which they had demonstrated a delicacy of touch that induced the most remarkable of sensations. Emerson has many admirable qualities, but patience is not one of them. Lost in my reveries, I failed to respond at once to his question. He seized me by the shoulders and spun me around to face him. His blue eyes blazed like sapphires, his lips curled back from his white teeth, and the dimple in his chin quivered ominously. "Why the devil don't you answer me?" he shouted. "How can you remain unmoved by such an appeal? What ails you, Peabody? I will be cursed if I can understand women. You ought to be on your knees thanking heaven and me for the happiness in store for you. It wasn't easy, you know, persuading De Morgan to give up his sight to us. It required all the subtle tact of which I am capable. No one but I could have done it. No one but I would have done it. And how do you repay me? By sighing and moping." It would have been immediately apparent to anyone familiar with the circumstances he described that Emerson was again engaging in his endearing habit of self-deception. The director of the Antiquities Service, Monsieur de Morgan, had yielded to us the archaeological site at which he himself had worked the previous year, and which had already produced a number of remarkable discoveries. However, Emerson's subtle tact, a quality that exists only in his imagination, had nothing to do with it. I was not precisely sure what had produced Monsieur de Morgan's change of heart, or, to be more exact, I had certain suspicions I preferred not to think about. It was a natural progression from those suspicions to the excuse I now uttered to account for my somber mood. "I am distressed about Ramses, Emerson. To have our son misbehave so badly, just when I had hoped we might get through one voyage without incident. How many boys of 8, I wonder, have been threatened with keel-hauling by the captain of a British merchant vessel?"